You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
The 3CR Gardening Show is coming to you today from the Woi Wurrung Nation. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional owners of this land. We recognise the practices of care and cultivation of the land and waters by the First Peoples and pay our respects to their elders past and present. Wherever you are and wherever you garden, we encourage you to know whose land you're on. Good morning, near and far. You are tuned in to the 3CR Gardening Show on the last day of spring. If you're with us live, thank you very much. And if you're podcasting, hello and g'day wherever you are. Joining me today is a very esteemed panel that I am privileged to share my Sunday morning with. A.B. Bishop saunters in at 7:29, horticultural editor of Gardening Australia magazine. Hello.
Hello, hello. Sorry about that. Yes, I got distracted, as you can see, by my... I feel like a bride coming in this morning with my posy of creamy-coloured flowers, which absolutely smell delightful, I might say.
Very bride-like. We will definitely get to those.
No weddings here today.
Fermi D'Souza, long-time 3CR listener, plants person and president of the Alpine Garden Society Victoria. Welcome again.
Thank you very much.
We're very happy to have you here, Fermi. And clocking up visit number two on the panel, Amy Downey, horticulturalist from the Royal Botanic Gardens, Melbourne, but acting team leader at the moment.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Yeah, it seems like an extreme title, but one more week of it before Tim can happily come back into his role.
And you can jump back in the garden.
Yes, I'm so looking forward to that. I'm definitely missing it at the moment.
You introduced a new plant species to me last time you were on, and I would just like to bring it back to the 3CR Gardening Show. Welcome again to Camellia Crapneliana.
Oh my gosh, it's so funny. It's just one of those names that I'm like, there must be a nicer way to pronounce that, mustn't there?
Yeah, good question.
It's one of those things, sorry, it's almost a rabbit hole that you can fall down. I was chatting with Terry Smythe, who's also a curator at the Botanic Garden. She looks after southern China, and asking her, like, how can I pronounce this in a nice way? And she was sharing that actually there's a book by, I think it's called Stern's Botanical Latin, that shares how you sort of pronounce Latin names, and that it's all about, I think, keeping the... There's like an emphasis should be the same on every syllable and every letter, so that is all just one sort of level. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So I don't know how that exactly works for Crapneliana, but there must be another way. But the example that she gave was sort of for clematis. Some people say clematis, and that's actually the correct name because there's no emphasis on one single letter.
Ah.
So again, I don't know how to not emphasize the crap in Crapneliana, but I'm trying to sort of put that into play on more of my botanical names. Yeah.
Virginia Haywood is the only person I've heard pronounce clematis as clematis.
Clematis. Yeah.
How do you usually say it?
Stephen says clematis sometimes.
Oh, probably. I mean, Stephen would be able to recite Stern's Botanical Latin. Like, word for word.
He would also say that there's no right or wrong in pronunciation.
Yeah.
Apart from things like Clivia.
Clivia, I was going to say that. That's his biggest bugbear.
Yeah, totally. Because it's named after the person.
Yeah. So, yeah, so I think somewhere in that dictionary it also says that you pronounce how the person's name is said.
Yes. Okay. Yes, that makes sense. So yeah, if it's a last name.
Crap. So glad we're saying this name.
So that's actually a real plant.
Yes. Yes. It's a beautiful camellia. It's got this amazing orange bark. So I always talk about it, but it's just an awkward name for me to say because it sounds so full on. I don't know. I'm always like, how can you say that a little bit kinder, gentler?
It would have been named after Mr. Crapnel.
Yes.
Yeah. So good. So good. Thanks for bringing that to the show, Amy. Fermi, you've come from a bit of a distance.
Oh, not this morning because we stayed in Melbourne overnight.
Yeah.
But we live up in Reedsdale, which is near Bendigo. And, we're north of the Divide. So when Melbourne gets lovely rainfall, we don't get anything because the Great Dividing Range divides us from the rain.
So how is spring been? What's your garden looking like at the moment and how has spring been
it's
for you?
Overgrown and weedy, but we've had some things have been really amazing. The alstroemerias have flowered really well this year, whereas some of the other things, some of the roses did really well initially, but now they're already been burning off with the dry.
Oh, really?
So, but that's mainly the one-time flowering roses. So,
You say one-time flowering roses.
Some of the old-fashioned roses only bloom once in the spring.
Oh,
so
right.
They're not remontant. They don't flower again. So that will get, you might occasionally get an odd flower on them, but mostly, a lot of the old roses, before they introduced the blood from the Chinese roses, they only flowered in spring. So you got a spring flowering of roses, then you had a green blob.
Right.
And but then the Chinese roses were recurrent. They flowered quite a lot. And so when they interbred them with the old European roses, that's when you started getting recurrent blooming. And so things that reach the peak with the hybrid teas, which flower on and on. And, of course, David Austin introduced the old-fashioned roses back into the hybrid tea breeding to breed the Austin roses, which are recurrent but old-fashioned, so they have an emphasis on form and colour and shape.
I needed you in my classroom on Friday because with my Cert 4s, we had a big cultivating genera day and we're like, you know, because there's certain things you do to roses a certain time of the year and sometimes you don't see that, you can't read that stuff in a book. So we covered roses and Banksia and then we went down a massive eucalyptus rabbit hole. But we were talking about hybrid tea and floribunda and I said, oh, and then there's... And this is just, I just didn't know. I was like, and then there's David Austin. And don't ask me about them because I don't know where they fit in at all. So David Austin is hybrid tea with the old world.
I'm pretty sure what he did was he brought it, they look like old world roses.
Yeah.
But he's introduced them, he's mixed, hybridized them so that they have that recurrent feature of modern roses. So he's blended the two in such a good way.
Ah, right. Because, with the modern roses, you keep deadheading throughout spring and summer and maybe get a few flowers into autumn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but with modern, the way they get those wonderful rose displays at Flemington is because they know that I think it's 6 to 8 weeks after you prune them, they'll come into flower again.
Well, can I tell you, we take students to Flemington for rose pruning and the horticulture team there are awesome. They're like, yeah, come in, because their pruning program runs from April to August. Mm. So the ones that have a longer period before flowering, I mean, everything needs to flower for cup week. So that's their deadline. They start in April.
Wow.
Rose pruning. So some stuff obviously takes a long time to flower or is a flowering.
They just keep recutting them back. So you'd get one flush of flowers and you prune them back and then 2 months later they'd flower again.
Yeah.
So,
and they've got trial beds. So whenever they bring in a new rose variety, and I think one of their horticulturalists who was there for 30 or 40 years would bring in all these new varieties and put them in the beds and prune them and work out how long it took from pruning to flowering before they went out into like the display beds.
Which makes sense. I mean, because wherever you are, they're going to be flowering at, slightly different times, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That makes sense.
It's fascinating.
So apparently one of the stories that one of my rosy friends told me was that David Austin came to Australia and he saw this bush of one of his roses and he said, oh, do you have three roses planted together to get that big effect? And they said, no, it's just one. And it's because of the climate in Australia that roses grow much more vigorously than they would back where he was growing them in the UK.
Really?
So
That's fascinating.
We have a particularly Melbourne has got an incredible climate for plants. Ruth Tyndale, who was my mentor in rock gardening, she told me they had visitors, tree specialists who came from, must be in the UK or America, and they looked at some of the trees on their property and they said, oh, this must be like 200 years old. And she said, this property wasn't settled until 100 years ago. And it was just that rate of growth that they got in the Dandenongs in particular was so far accelerated, but at a not a really rapid growth like some of the gums, but at a fairly steady but an increased rate of growth.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, temperate climates will, I suppose, probably contribute to that.
Mm.
Volcanic soil, well drained. Oh, in the Dandenongs, yeah. Beautiful volcanic soil. Yeah, a bit different to where you are, AB.
A little bit different, yeah.
What's happening in your garden at the moment?
Quite a lot, I suppose. I mean, our garden is pretty much an extension of the bush, and we like it that way. We've got pretty much mostly indigenous plants, so there's various things flowering, but we've managed to get rid of most of the rabbits, so some of the other plants, it's really difficult, like, being in the bush. There's always someone that's going to eat something, and if they're not eating it, then the cockies are coming along and, you know, just having a real go at everything, which is, it's so frustrating. Like, you can have, I've got a row of South African bulbs, actually, that I've got a bit of a collection happening, and they've just been growing there happily for a few years, and then all of a sudden the cockies decide, no, we really don't like these guys, and come along and just absolutely create havoc and spread them, yeah, all over the place, and they sort of lament and carry on. Hope that they come back next year. But the garden itself, it's great. We're having lots of rain, of course, so that's very much appreciated. And we've got our resident wombat, Wendy. She's she's had a baby, and the baby is been out of the pouch for a few months now, and in the burrow. And so we've had a few visits from the baby as well. And of course, when they're in a in their pouch, backward-facing pouch, so when they're getting older, they've got their head sticking out. So when Wendy has been coming down, you introduce yourself to the baby. So the baby's got his little head sticking out the pouch and, you know, it smells you and you give it a little pat and everything. So by the time it comes back from being out of the burrow, it actually knows you.
Yeah.
So it's the cutest little thing, and it sort of jumps around the place. And is,
have you named it yet? You've got
not
Wendy.
Yet. Yeah, we've got Wendy, and we've got her baby from last year, Frankie. So we... if we don't know whether they're male or female, we tend to give them sort of, you know, a bit of a generic name.
Yes.
So Frankie could be either a male or female. And then we have a baby from the previous year, and we just call that the big one. so this new one, really trying to, I thought, oh, you know, while it's young, we could just quickly pick it up and have a look and see if it's male or female. Because it's very friendly. But, yeah, so that's sort of a bit of the highlight of the garden at the moment, which is a lot of fun having them around. And in terms of plants, I mean, we've got the veggie garden happening. I finally managed to convince Ray to take down. We had this massive bay tree, which was just getting bigger and bigger.
Oh, they're huge. They just don't stop.
Taking over the whole veggie garden, and was completely in the wrong spot and just shading out everything. And I finally managed to convince Ray that for the sake of picking two bay leaves a year for the spag bowl, we can let it go. So he kindly chopped that down, and it hasn't come back, thank goodness.
Oh. Was it suckering?
It's not suckering yet. So I'm expecting it may, but that was a case of where we chopped it, and then I don't have... glyphosate. So I don't have any Roundup, but I did have some Slasher, so I poured that on neat.
Yep.
So I'm hoping that sort of made a bit of a difference, and maybe it won't sucker. But yeah, so that's really obviously opened up the garden incredibly, and so one particular section now I've sort of given over to just a mix of veg, tomatoes, capsicum. Mm-hmm. What have we else? We've got
asparagus.
Oh my God, my asparagus is still going. Like, it has been going for like 3 months now, been picking spears.
Wow.
But it's just starting to get to the stage where the spears are getting too thin for harvesting. So just letting them go to their ferns, and then they'll just be ferny for the rest of the summer and into pretty much all of autumn. Then they slowly go yellow and eventually I'll chop them down and it'll all start again. I have to say, the asparagus bed is my... This is my pride and joy, and I just love it. Like last year, I freaked out because the rats got every spear, every spear. So that was really depressing. But this year, I don't know, something's weird's been happening. We just don't really have as many rats, thank goodness. I think maybe the owls, I have been hearing the powerful owl and the southern bubuk, so I think maybe they're doing their... work.
Yeah, they're having a feasting. Yeah. They know that they can get rats that aren't poisoned at your house. Maybe.
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, we don't use poison at all. So
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you have the? Were you on? Somebody on 3CR mentioned about this rat killing machine. That's me.
That was the. It's a New Zealand now. Because I had a mental blank as to what it is. But, yeah, it's a New Zealand trap that was developed to kill rats in the forests, which were decimating the local population of birds. And so they've developed it and it's powered by just a little carbon dioxide thing that you know, you can pump up your bike tyres with essentially, so you can buy the replacement ones at the bike shop rather than through them. And, so it essentially hammers a rat to death. So they're dead, like, in 3 seconds. And it will keep working. So, you know, we've had instances where there's been 2 rats that have been killed at once. And it's really weird because, I mean, of course rats are really smart, but for some reason they, when they're going for this lure, they just go for it. And there's different lures. There's chocolate and peanut butter and stuff. And... they just keep coming. So it was designed, as I say, to use that in the forest so that the rats just kept coming and didn't matter how many rats got killed, they would still come and then they'd sort of fall out and just lie next to the trap and then get taken up by predator birds.
We often have, you know, I mean, everyone, all the panellists on the show, all our listeners, we all have rat issues in veggie patches and all that. And that... Everyone's like, AB uses a hydraulic thing. At some point during the show, we'll get you to find the name of it. And no doubt we'll get someone text in or call up at asking for the actual name of it and where they can get it.
Yeah, so you can get it online. Good Nature. There we go.
Hey, well done.
Yeah, thank you. Good Nature Trap. But I will say it has its limitations. If there's any food around, they just won't use it. You need to just make sure, you know, if you've got any pet food around, if you've got chickens, you know, that you chuck scraps out to, just try and get rid of all of those sorts of things, even the compost and everything. They will go to that before they'll go to the trap.
Okay, so that needs to be the best and only option.
Absolutely, yep.
Yeah. Interesting.
But no, definitely worthwhile. As I say, for being able to, you know, any rats that get killed by these traps, we just leave out. And interestingly, it's the currawongs who will come down and grab them. So
really?
Yeah.
I thought they were seed eaters.
Oh, no. Currawongs are nasty. they're predator birds. They're omnivores, so they will certainly eat fruit and seeds and things. But, yeah, no, they'll eat little birds and eggs and all sorts of things.
No, you're right, because the currawongs, when we had our old dog and the dog didn't eat all her food, the currawongs would come and make a mess of her food.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then they would... leave their little special presents.
Yes.
But they were filled with seed.
Yeah. So they regurgitate them. If they come across protein, which obviously is, better for them in terms of sort of growth, etc., they will regurgitate. So their pellets, they regurgitate what they've eaten, you know, might even be sort of beetles, and you'll often see little beetle shells in there and seed heads and all those sorts of things. So they regurgitate that and then... Yeah.
This makes so much sense because the little things that I thought were their poos, I was like, they were big. They were like the size of a Malteser.
Yeah, they're big.
And that would be really hard for a bird to push out.
That's their pellets.
Right. Yeah. Oh, man, you learn so much on this show.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. And you just get a stick and, dissect them and you can see what they've been eating.
Yeah. Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Well, listeners, you are so lucky. You are tuned in to the 3CR Gardening Show this morning.
We're talking about crap and poo and all sorts of nice things.
My favourite topic, toilet toilet humour.
Show for 6-year-olds.
Yeah. I'm Chloe Foster. With me today is AB Bishop, Fermi D'Souza and Amy Downey. If you want to join the chat, ask a question or make a comment, give us a call on 94190155. The text message line is open. The number for that is 0488 809 855. We are on social media, so the pictures of plants that we talk about on the show get put up to our Facebook and social media, Facebook and Instagram accounts, and we're 3CR Gardening Show is the handle for both of those. I can't get text messages on via the text line, so if you have any questions via with photos, send us an email, 3cr.gardening@gmail.com. Fermi, you brought in a lovely basket of plants. Do you want to talk? Do you want to start with one of them?
One of them. Okay. Well, I'll start with one of my favourites, and this is this little yellow starry flower. So this is a Tritelia. So this is not South African, surprisingly enough. It's actually from North America, and Tritelias. In Australia, in the trade, you usually get a very blue one called, they call it Queen Fabiola, but that should be purple.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But the blue Tritelia laxa is was very common in all the gardening magazine adverts for bulbs for spring. This is Tritelia ixioides, and it's a yellow version of that Tritelia. And it flowers really well, and does set a little bit of seed. Those mostly seed pods there that'll be germinating in the spring sometime. It's a good flower for. You can get a good mass of them because you can grow a lot of seed and grow a whole heap of them in the rock. They suit the rock garden very well, but they can grow in an ordinary garden. We have them in raised beds around the place. And it's a North American bulb that's quite beautiful.
Yeah.
That whole group is known as the Themids or Themidaceae, and that's Tritelia, Brodia, Iphion, and things like that. And they're quite useful plants in the garden. So.
Very, very nice. Beautiful. Yeah. Did you say the species name was Ixioides?
Ixioides,
because the flower does look a little bit like Ixias.
Yeah.
It's got that star, like the star shape.
Yes.
Yeah. Classic star shape.
Yeah, very so, good. But, yeah, they all have very starry sort of flowers, except some of the Brodias. And Dicholastemma is one of the groups. I didn't bring that in because I only have one in flower and I'm letting it set seed.
That's right. We'll forgive you this time. You can bring in next time. Now, I did send you a question during the week. I was hoping you might have a response to it.
No, the question was, somebody said their Bechnoria was dropping flowers whenever they touched the flower. So apart from thinking that it was allergic to her, the only thing I can think of is sometimes some flowers will abort if the temperature is wrong, like if it's been expecting warm weather because it's spring and suddenly we get a cold snap, that the flowers will tend to drop.
Yeah. So,
but I've not seen it with Bechnoria.
AB, are you familiar with that plant?
Oh, God, no.
No.
One of the things I love coming in, like if it's Furby or Jane or Stephen and they just bring these plants and I look at them and I go, ooh, that's another world.
Yeah, me too.
No
like,
idea.
Furby just getting talking better, about this North American bulb and I was just like, that's beautiful. I never met that bulb before.
Yeah.
So many to learn, too many to learn.
But, I was thinking about the Bechnoria dropping flowers and they touch it. Maybe too dry or too wet where it's growing
that's
sort of only just holding it on and it gets knocked over.
They're a very hardy plant. They grow, I mean, they'd be great for the grey garden.
Yeah, we have some.
Well, can you shed any light for us, Ames?
I can't, I'm sorry. I have not seen it happen yet, so it's very interesting.
Yeah, it's a really, really unique plant.
How do you spell it?
That's a good question, AB. Bechnoria.
Ooh,
it's in the asparagus family.
Oh,
you haven't got it in your asparagus garden?
Probably not. Interesting.
My thought with that is just maybe if it's too wet.
Too wet, too dry. Or that sudden change in temperature may have done that.
Yeah, it seems a bit more environmental around the plant.
Yeah.
Did they say if it was in a pot or in the ground?
No, and if that listener is maybe tuning in today, because I think it was a text message, if you want to text in again, because I don't have your name, please text in or call in and we can have a chat about it.
You know, if it's in a pot, it might have run out of food or something.
Maybe. Yep, might need a feed. Yep. Mm. And another question that they didn't get to last week is a listener asked, should they plant up their potted Scedoxys multiflorus now? And the answer to that is yes.
Good to know.
So that was a text message they couldn't get to last week. The text line is 0488 809 855. And the phone number is 94190155. If you want to join the chat in any way, please call in. It'd be nice to know that other people, other than my mum, is listening this morning.
And mine.
And your mum. Yes, shout out to your mum. AB,
yeah.
Your little bridal bouquet, what did you bring in?
Well, I always find it a bit tricky picking flowers and bringing them in because I always feel a little bit guilty because I do want to leave them in the bush for the animals. And I specifically didn't pick some kangaroo apple flower. And we've got some in our garden. That's the Solanum laciniatum. And the reason I didn't pick it is because the rosellas love the fruit. And I love watching the rosellas in the plant. So I could have. But I do want to talk about it. So the kangaroo apple, it's one of my favourite plants because it's so fast growing. Like it is almost sort of weedy growing in a way, and a lot of people do sort of put it into that weedy category. But, you know, it gets to maybe about 2-3 metres and it's almost like a small tree. So it has a central trunk, you know, maybe a few branches coming off and a really wide crown. So the crown itself might be 2-3 metres and beautiful green leaves but kind of quite sort of light foliage and these beautiful purple flowers at this time of year. And it's a fantastic plant if you're trying to sort of establish a garden but it's too hot and sunny. So you can get these guys going first while you're growing something else underneath. Mm. So in a few years' time, by the time those other plants have established in that sort of slightly shaded position, the kangaroo apples are dying off. So they'll only last sort of 4, 5, 6 years. And I tend to sort of leave their dead structure because then the wrens come in and use it to argue with each other, which is kind of nice to watch. But, yeah, it's such a useful plant. So that's, the kangaroo apple, which I'm sure you guys will all know quite well. But, yeah, this time of year it is flowering purple. But the ones that I have brought in...
Can I ask you a question, though, about it? When the rosellas come to eat the fruit, what colour stage do they eat the fruit at?
Really ripe. Really? So, they're quite orange, so they're sort of like egg-shaped fruit and they're green to start with and then they turn light yellow and then they turn orange and finally red. And, yeah, so they like them when they're really ripe.
Yeah.
So it's... and
that's interesting.
It is, yeah. The tricky thing is the branches are quite sort of... I wouldn't say fragile, but they're thin. So the rosellas coming in, they will often break the branches. Mm. So ours has got various broken branches on, which still grow, which are still alive. They're good for those sorts of animals, which I just think it's really important. The king parrots will have a go at them as well.
Do the cockies go for them?
No, and I think that might just be because the plants just don't hold their weight.
Yep.
You know, as much as cockies do like to have a go at other things, like I've got an acacia scarlet blaze and that has been ravaged in the past before. So I've got my fourth scarlet blaze. I'm absolutely determined to grow one. So this one I've actually put in a pot because I've had them in the past and in the ground and, you know, not overwatered them and they've been going great guns and then all of a sudden we'll have a few days of really heavy rain and then... turn up their toes, it's all over. So I've got this one in a pot, but still the cockies try to land on them and have a go, and they're really light. So
blows me away with Acacia Scarlet Blaze, you know, saying that a bit of rain and it turns its toes up. Because, I mean, you and I both worked at Karanga Native Nursery at some point, which is right on the Alinda Creek.
Yeah.
So you're close to the water table. But there was some, I can remember maybe three different plants of Acacia Scarlet Blaze growing growing underneath the gum trees, and maybe that was the trick.
Sucking it up a little bit more.
Yeah.
I mean, ours I had planted under a big polyanthemus, so a big red box, and it's a raised bed, so it's probably raised maybe 20 centimetres. And it's the original soil, but it's much more well-drained just because we'd sort of turned it over, etc. They just didn't like it there. So after three goes of trying it there, I put it in a pot, or put one in a pot, and it's very happy so far, touch wood.
I think my mum's on to her third or her fourth Grevillea petrophilioides, which I know you've heard a lot about, AB. In 2020, just before we went into a damned lockdown, mum poisoned her lawn. It took me a few years to work on her to get rid of the front lawn, because front lawn is just useless. Yep. Anyway, that's my opinion. And I was like, mum, you want more room to plant plants. Let's get rid of your front garden. She finally said yes. So we poisoned the lawn. We got our landscaper friend in with a little excavator, and he dug it up, and we put in new topsoil and created a big mounded garden bed, mainly so that she could grow her favourite Grevillea, Grevillea petrophilioides, which is a bit of a mouthful. I can't remember its common name. Can you remember its common name? No. It'll come to me. Anyway, so she's bought it grafted. We planted everything up with some other, a whole heap of other plants in the front garden, and everything's going really well except for this Grevillea. It's died at least three times.
Oh, no.
She's tried...
Oh, pink pokers.
Pink pokers. Yep. Thank you. She's tried it with different grafting rootstocks. So it's usually grafted onto Grevillea robusta, but sometimes that's a questionable whether it's a match or not. So she got it from another nursery and with a different rootstock, and that died too. And she's getting really, really frustrated because this thing wasn't growing, and that's why we've done this whole bed. So as an aside, Grevillea petrophilioides is a West Australian sort of arid-dwelling Grevillea, grows in really, really dry areas. Over at Melton Botanic Gardens, it is thriving. It is a beautiful large shrub. They've got sort of raised garden beds over in Melton too, but Melton Botanic Gardens gets less than 500 mil of rainfall a year.
Wow.
Mum's in the eastern, on the eastern side of Melbourne in Croydon, and it's probably around 700, maybe 800 mil of rainfall a year there. Yep. So I think that's one of the main things, because the drainage in that garden is fine.
But that's another thing. I mean, the drainage, because that mix that she brought in would have been quite sandy.
Yeah.
So you think sort of well drained. But then you think of a lot of the WA plants, they're growing maybe in gravelly soils, but a lot of them are sort of gravelly clay soils. So they're really sort of well structured. And they're still well draining, but they're not draining in the same way that a sand would drain. So sand drains super fast,
yeah,
and it's kind of gone. And then under your mum's raised bed, there's just clay,
yeah,
of course. But yeah, in the WA, we were there recently, and the soil was one of the most interesting things. Just grabbing a handful of it, and it's so well structured and will still hold together well, but you can just tell from all the sort of gravel in it that it just, yeah, it drains really, really well. And it would drain for a really good depth, whereas your mum's bed, even though that was quite raised, it's still sitting on that real sort of dense clay that's not well draining.
Yeah, it's been such a conundrum. Anyway, we were talking about it when Peter May was it earlier this year or earlier last year? Gosh, time flies. Peter May was on the show, and he said, "Oh, try getting a treat it like a pot plant." So, and buy a sort of a big steel circle, one of those steel rings, about 30, it's probably 30 or 40 centimetres high, and fill it with potting mix and plant it into that so that the root system can become a bit more established before it reaches. Because, yeah, the clay subsoil underneath is probably okay, because some of those, so bizarre, like those WA soils, like you said, can be gravelly and sandy, but like gravelly and clayey.
Yeah.
But there can be sand, like that well-drainedness, but sitting on top of a clay subsoil.
Yeah.
Anyway, so sort of got a mini version of that in a way. So can it put it into the steel ring that's and fill it with potting mix? Yep. And then once, hopefully, it'll be a bit more established before it gets down to the soil down below. It's still alive, this fourth one.
Is that what she's done?
Yeah, she's put it in, she did that. Yep, she's done that. And it's still alive. So relieved. And, yeah, I hope it keeps surviving. But I think this may be a solution.
Yep.
Because I think also the rainfall, I think it's just the rainfall in the area.
And humidity, of course.
And, yeah, yep. And that as well possibly contributed to it.
What are, like, the other species she has growing well in her garden?
Okay, so got prostrate acacia cardiophylla, the Wyalong beautiful, what's it called? Gold lace cultivar, the prostrate one.
Yes, I love that
one. It's stunning, absolutely stunning. That's growing so well.
Right.
Other grevilleas are growing really well in there.
Yep.
There's a couple of the Pycnosaurus globosus, the billy buttons.
Mm-hmm.
One of them's done fine, but the other one's died off pretty early.
Yep.
And... yeah, it's been a really interesting journey with that garden. And it was interesting bringing in that sandy loam topsoil because there's no organic content in there at all. So I think some plants have struggled in there because there's been no organic matter for them.
Mm-hmm.
We mulched really thickly, but then it was a bit – but then we had those La Nina years from 2020, 21 into 22 and – the garden was really wet for a while. So we had a Eucalyptus erythrocoris there, the red cap gum, which grows coastal sands around Perth. So that one dropped off. She's got another one in there now. It's just really, I'm like, Mum, you're just really trying to grow some really hard plants.
I have a solution for you, Mum.
Oh.
Move to WA. You know? Or has she heard of local indigenous?
Yes, there is some local stuff. There's some local grasses in there that have done all right. But I put in, because when we first put in, we're like, dry garden bed, and it just being the black summer bushfires. So we put in some Ostrostyper. Well, they dropped off straight away because it was just way too wet for them.
Mm.
Like Ostrostyper, the local species, will grow in the driest of dry soils. So they dropped off. Gosh, I can't remember what else dropped. The swamp daisies, the Actinodium, they lasted for a while because it was so wet for a couple of years. And Karanga sells them with the little fusspot label on them, but they were fine. It's been a journey. It's been a challenging journey, that garden.
I remember that time of year was really tricky where it was super wet because I think I shared last time on the show that sort of the similar time, we were really excited to get this Bismarck palm down from Queensland that grows really well up there, and it's a Madagascan palm. And we thought this is a great sort of climate-matched species to have, especially in the Grey Garden, which is quite a hot spot for, you know, also future predicted climate. And so we got down these three palms, shipped them all the way from Queensland and put them in, and it was super, super wet season. All three of them died away. But I shared last time that I left one in the ground just in case, and it's just started to come back. It's got a new leaf coming up.
What a treat.
But it was one of these things we thought, this is great. This is going to be wonderful, you know, as things are getting hotter. Hopefully it's going to be really happy here, and it just was too wet for them. They weren't ready for the cold of Melbourne, I think.
Yeah.
Couldn't hack it.
That was some weird years.
That's such a good lesson, isn't it? Just to leave plants be, because sometimes they do take a while to reestablish.
Yes. Yeah.
My mum had – I'm just trying to think what it was that she had in a pot now. Anyway, she had this plant in the ground and it was really suffering, and we moved it to a pot and it sat in a pot for ages, like months and months and months, and she said, I'm going to pull it out. I'm like, just give it a little bit longer, and finally it just started shooting again. So sometimes I think, especially if they're not in their right climate or their preferred conditions, they will just take a while to adapt. So it's a shame you took the other two out.
I think the same, because looking at them, completely dead, completely. Like, I was actually amazed that I didn't take the other one out. I think I just couldn't because I'd gone through all the trouble of getting them. But now it is the question of, like, well, actually, if we had have left them, could they all have survived?
Yeah.
But they just looked so dead. It looked like there was no hope. But it's such a good lesson of just give them a little extra time. You never know. Yeah.
And I often think, like, dead plants aren't even really dead. They're only dead because to us we go, oh, they don't have any foliage, you know, the bark's all flaked off, etc. But they're still such a microcosm for so many critters. Like, to me, they're just not dead.
Yeah. Such good habitat.
Totally, which I know you wouldn't necessarily want to have that in the botanic garden. But
such a balance, though, and there's definitely collections that's what it's all about. It's still about having that balance there and, you know, creating that space for native birds and things to come too. So I do think that there's, a place for it there, just a balance.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see what happens with this grevillea, but it's the one that survived the longest. So we'll see how it goes.
Good luck.
It is one of the grafted ones. Mum did try some ungrafted, and then the Panrock Princess, which is a hybrid. And
On her for persevering.
Oh, she is a very persistent woman. All right, we've got a couple of text messages coming in. Lizzie from Geelong says, hello, team. She's missed some podcasts. Yes, our podcast guy has had a lot on in his life lately and he hasn't got a couple of episodes up, so we're working on it. And there's been a couple of glitches for us as well, so we're working on getting them back up. Thanks for asking, Lizzie, and FYI everyone else. Another listener says, are there any updates on Beasley's Nursery and Poynton's Nursery as they are both on the market? Well, I have the answer to one of them, and it is public now, so we can say it. Alexa Clark, one of the owners of Kuranga Native Nursery, announced last week that Kuranga has bought Beasley's Nursery in Warrandyte, and they're going to turn it into another Kuranga.
Wow.
I really want to be a fly on the wall when the customers who are used to Beasley first come in and go,
where are the
what's happened?
Yeah. Very exciting.
That is so exciting.
Brave and, and it's such a beautiful nursery. Like, it's so aesthetically lovely, and they're going to turn it into pretty much a replica as much as they can of Kuranga in terms of having everything in, you know, small shrubs, medium shrubs, ground covers, etc. So it'll be easy for people to work out what to get.
The set out of Kuranga Nursery is the best. It's so easy. Setting it out in growth habit like that, and then alphabetical order within that.
Yep.
Oh, I just love it. And Beasley's is a beautiful setting. It's sort of, apart from the big road running down the side, it's quite similar to the Mount Evelyn property, being close to the Mullum Creek.
Yeah, and on a hill, so you sort of got all the backdrop of the trees behind, and there's a cafe there, etc.
Yeah.
I was going to say, whereabouts is it located?
It's on Warrandyte Road.
Oh. Yeah, it's right on the cusp of Warrandyte and Templestowe.
Right, yes. Mm. Oh, lovely.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah. It's the bigger intersection is near. I think it's Anderson's Creek Road and Warrandyte Road.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
But listener, I don't know about Poynton's Nursery. So I think Doug's just writing in a note to us. They're still taking expressions of interest. So if you're interested in buying a nursery, Poynton's is still on the market. Very exciting. Congratulations to Kuranga there.
Yes.
It's really cool. I mean, they're a massive specialist nursery. Mm-hmm. And it's really cool that they're sort of spreading their wings.
Yeah, and they won the NGIV Horticultural Nursery Retailer
of the year.
So kudos to them and what they've done. It's funny because I went to a talk that Alexa gave recently, and she was mentioning how when her and Ben took over and started making a few tweaks, and to me they were amazing tweaks, but they actually copped a bit of flack for it. And I felt really disappointed because it really, to me, they've just breathed new life into it. So, I mean, that the gift shop there is just exceptional, and they really support local creators, whether it's writers or makers, etc. You go into that gift shop and you can get something local. It's all to do with native flora and fauna, And ditto the cafe, you know, their menu is based around.
I agree. I reckon Ben and Alexa have just put Karanga on steroids with what they've done.
Yeah.
And the variety of plants, they've built up the production area again and they're growing more of their own stuff. It's
Well, they bought a propagation area in Wonga Parks and just created the state of the art.
Yeah.
Yeah. Propagation area with the most amazing, not glass houses as such, but still got, really good propagation.
Yeah.
Do you remember, were you around when, in its first incarnation, when it was Ringwood? In Ringwood?
I did go to it once, but I wasn't really in the horticultural world then, so I didn't really know.
I think the best thing they did was move to Mount Evelyn. Yep. They just had room to move.
Yeah.
Whereas Ringwood, I think it was so hemmed in by industrial sort of stuff.
It was.
So, but, yeah.
Actually, that's on the Mullum Mullum Creek there too, so they're kind of coming home, going back to Beasley site.
Yeah,
I remember I was very little when I went to the Ringwood site. I remember buying a lemon-scented tea tree in a tube when we were there.
I just remember the tram. There was a tram at the front.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Whoa, throwback. Yep. Yep. Okay. All right. Okay. We're just reminiscing now. If you want to join the chat, give us a call on 94190155 or text line is 0488 809 855. I'm Chloe Foster. This is a 3CR gardening show, and in the studio with me this morning is AB Bishop, Fermi D'Souza and Amy Downey. I have a community announcement that I must get to. There's just one today, and it is Open Gardens Victoria for a garden that is open next Sunday. So it's not open Saturday, it's just next Sunday, the 7th of December. It is the Garden of Hope, 8 Beverly Hills Drive, Templestowe. It's open from 10 till 4. The interesting thing about the opening next weekend on Sunday is that they're having a summer opening and an autumn opening of this garden. So Sunday the 7th of December and Sunday the 19th of April. There's a special price for attending the garden on both days, or you can just go once. It was designed by local designer Jackie Cherwin using the existing mature trees. So Jackie has a really special eye for detail. There's a gorgeous combination of plants that flower throughout all seasons and different foliage colours throughout all the seasons as well. So there's heaps of inspiration in the Garden of Hope. So the summer opening is the 7th of December and the autumn opening is Sunday the 19th of April. So entry is $10 for adults and $6 for students. For the single entrance. If you want to visit on both days, it's $18. There's more information at the Open Gardens Victoria website, but they're a wonderful organisation and they have given a free double pass for one of our listeners. So give us a call on 94190155. Speak to Doug if you want to pick up the tickets for the Garden of Hope in 8 Beverly Hills Drive, Templestowe. Okay, now moving on to another text message that came in. Someone was very organised last night when they sent this text message in to us. And it's you have a fan in Gippsland, Amy.
How exciting.
Cat in Gippsland. Loved hearing about your abseiling for endangered species in New South Wales last time you were on. You sounded so passionate about what you do and she found it very inspiring. Mm. Have you this is a cool question.
Mm-hmm.
She asks, have you found it as a woman breaking into the horticultural industry, in particular extreme horticulture, when it seems like a very male-dominated area? What's your experience been?
Oh, thank you so much, Kat, for the message. That's so lovely and it's so exciting to talk about because I was just on the escarpment at the Botanic Gardens the other day, so I was just getting to climb and thinking how lucky I was to be able to do it as well. But thanks for writing in. That's such a good question and I do have to say that I think I have been so far, you know, in the short time that I've sort of been in the horticulture industry, so that's just over 7 years, I've spent a lot of time at the Botanic Gardens, and I've been so fortunate to have been surrounded by such amazing women and such sort of strong role models, not just at the Botanic Gardens, but even Chloe Foster here was my teacher at TAFE. You know, I've had people like Terry Smythe, who I mentioned earlier, who's been at the gardens now for over 30 years. So I've had some really amazing, strong women role models in the industry and such support from them. So I've always had, I think, this really fortunate experience where it's never quite felt like a challenge for me or that I haven't felt supportive. And I also want to say as well, at the Botanic Gardens, there's also a lot of my male colleagues too who are super supportive. So I'm very lucky. I know not everybody's experience is the same, but so far for me in the industry, there are such amazing women who I can sort of connect with and be inspired by and follow in their footsteps. Even, you know, they've got amazing sort of groups like Encouraging Women in Horticulture who make it really easy for me to be able to feel like I can go out there and give things a go and, you know, not be affected by gender at all. In this sort of extreme horticulture side of things, and especially with escarpment horticulture, I mean, for me, it's still quite new and it's also something I'm still sort of learning who else is involved in it. So we are sort of hoping, I do have my two climbing partners are both male, but we are hoping to train up Cassie to be able to do it with me. So again, it's sort of such a new space for me that I haven't met a lot of other people yet who have been involved. But again, I've been really supported, especially from the Botanic Gardens in doing that and progressing in that, that I've been very fortunate to not have had yet too many troubles with it.
It was when you finished your apprenticeship that that's when you came into curation of the Grey Garden.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Who said we need to get some carabiners and abseil down this Grey Garden?
Yeah. So it was sort of yes, because it was something that they used to do years before. So again, an amazing woman, Alison Rice, used to be the curator of the Botanic Gardens. Oh, sorry, the curator of the Grey Garden at the Botanic Gardens in Melbourne, years and years before me. And then it was sort of an art that she began of getting in these anchor points to be able to climb on this escarpment there. And then once she left, it was a lost art, and it'd been a few other curators sort of passed through that weren't able to get that training. And so when I was very fortunate to get that position, it was definitely something that straight away I was like, absolutely, we need to do this. And then Tim Ubergang, who started shortly after me, who's my team leader, he was the one who, you know, really pushed it through and was really supportive and also wanting to access that site to not only be able to maintain that space but also use it for sort of ex situ collections and important conservation work. So without Tim's support, and again, Claire Hart, the manager of the Botanic Gardens, it wouldn't be possible. Yeah. But Tim was someone who really helped push this through and was equally as interested as I was to get that climbing and get that skill kind of going again.
Yeah. But you're obviously not scared of heights.
No, although I have to admit there was definitely a moment on the recent field trip, which was, you know, a 300-metre cliff face, and we were 90 metres down, and there was just this small ledge where just the tip of my toes was the only thing kind of hanging on. There was a moment where my knees did shake a tiny bit. But normally I'm very lucky that it doesn't bother me too much. Yeah.
So is escarpment horticulture a thing worldwide?
See, the name is sort of something that we've come up with. I'm sure that there are other names for it, but because we have what we call the escarpment, that's what we've sort of named it. Mm-hmm. But I do know it's definitely something that other places, I have seen other places doing it, and I know there's a place in France that does a very similar thing where they have a beautiful botanic garden. I'll have to find the name. And they sort of abseil down and they use hedges to shape these beautiful balls growing on the side of this sort of cliff escarpment thing, which I think is much higher than ours. So, yes, it's again, I have to keep expanding and learning more because it's definitely we're not the only ones doing it. I just don't know yet all the places that are. I've seen a couple and I'm trying to connect with them.
Yeah.
I know the Blue Mountains do similar sort of, I guess, conservation work with climbing on, I think, near like waterfalls and things like that, and also using drones to be able to see what species are growing there. So I know they're doing a lot of work in this space too. But again, it's that sort of exciting adventure that we're on of like discovering who else is doing it and hopefully collaborating with them and learning from each other. And Kings Park, WA, I think that they've had all the trouble with the shot hole borer.
Oh,
yeah.
So I think they had to remove a lot of trees that were on their escarpment.
Yeah, okay.
And do a little bit of that work. So, yeah it's definitely out there. Yeah. I'm just trying to, connect and find other people and keep expanding.
Yeah. I mean, I've never seen you when you're at TAFE, which was a while ago now, there was two girls in your apprentice class.
Yes, yeah.
Tara, I think, worked for City of Yarra.
Yes.
And that didn't seem to faze either of you girls at all, that you were just the two girls in a very raucous group of boys. That was a big apprenticeship group.
That's actually...
What I have seen, you just jump into everything, you have a go.
Thank you.
Like, you just go, yep, cool, I will abseil down this cliff, sure. My knees knock at the top of those things. I can't go over them. That's me, though. Like,
I think... I don't know. I think I was very fortunate, again, to be probably raised by such beautiful, strong women who also just gave me that belief of, like, even anything that you can't do or that is uncomfortable, like, you can learn it. There's no reason you can't learn this thing. There's no reason you won't get better at it. So I think they just really instilled that belief in me of that anything is possible and to just give it a go and that you will always improve. And even if it feels really uncomfortable at the start, like, it won't in a month's time or in a year's time. So, again, I think it's all down to that very fortunate thing of I've had such amazing, strong women role models in my life.
Yeah.
Yeah, for a long time.
I've found, too, my experience when I was working in public horticulture at the zoo and the gardens, that I never felt any major gender bias either. It was you were there with your skills and your knowledge, and gender didn't really come into it for me. I had female managers and male managers, and all the girls, you know, did what the boys did.
Yes.
I never felt. There's have been some other workplaces where it's been a little bit different, but in public horticulture, I feel like it's a bit more equitable. Across the genders.
I think you're right. I think it is, you know, it's amazing that there are these organisations out there that are making sure, I think they prioritise that and making sure that it's a safe space, because you're right, I don't think there's definitely would be places out there where that's not the case.
Yeah.
But places like the Botanic Gardens and the zoo, I think, really prioritise having that as the culture.
Yeah.
I think one of the leaders in that space, of course, is the beautiful Jane Edmondson, who, if people watched Gardening Australia on Friday night, would know that she has retired from the show.
Yeah.
So she was certainly a leader when she first got into nursery work. She was banging on doors saying, let me work in the nursery. And
she got a lot of no's.
She got a lot of no's for a long time. And kudos to Jane for pretty much leading the way for pretty much all of us.
Yeah.
And, you know, she will be missed certainly on Gardening Australia.
Yeah.
She will. But I'm pretty sure she's still going to be around the industry doing various things.
Yeah.
Jane's
just phenomenal. I've just never heard a bad word about her. She's just always happy to chat and interested in whatever anyone is doing.
Yeah, when I was on GATV, so I was a researcher there for about 4 years, and I studied horticulture late, and Gardening Australia in a way was my apprenticeship, and I was Jane's researcher. So, you know, I learned so much from Jane, and she was always so giving and so knowledgeable, of course. So it was funny having to be the researcher for someone who knew like 400 times more than I did. But she was always fantastic.
Yeah.
So never hear a bad word of her. And she's the first person, you know, if you ask her a question, she doesn't know, she'll just be like,
no idea. Yeah. You know, she's not afraid to say she doesn't know and that there's still so much to learn. So yeah. I think that's certainly something that I've taken from what she's given me.
Yeah, she's definitely paved the way for a lot of girls,
people, yeah,
in gardens in Australia,
yeah, and even also being in the media, you know, just being brave enough to have a voice. I think, I think we need to keep women sort of at the forefront so that we can hear what they've got to say. Women say things in a different way, and we appreciate different things. And we need both men and women to be giving their opinion of plants and horticulture and gardening so that we get a really broad picture of it all.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I hope Jane can enjoy spending a bit more time in her garden now.
Her beautiful garden.
Yeah.
Wild garden. So many plants in there.
I bet there is. I can only imagine how many plants people have given her whenever she's gone visiting somewhere, all the random single of plants that she must have in her garden. Well, thank you, Kat in Gippsland, for that question.
Kat. Yeah, great question.
And if you're either in or you're thinking about getting into horticulture, there are some very supportive workplaces around. And if you find yourself in a workplace that isn't supportive, get out of there straight away and move on to the next one.
Yeah.
Because there are plenty of wonderful, supportive, equitable for everyone workplaces.
Absolutely.
In the industry. Yeah. The Open Gardens Victoria tickets have gone. I haven't had any calls this morning. I think we're on air. The number is 94190155. The text line is 0488 809 855, and there have been some text messages come in. Tall Carlos from Croydon says Ringwood Karanga. They liked the big boulders out the front and was surprised when they told him that they were made from mesh and concrete. They weren't legitimate boulders. Oh, that's a really cool memory.
That makes me think of, sorry to cut in, but at the Grey Garden a couple of years ago, they had a bit of a refresh around the outside of the temple and re-exposed a lot of the old Guilfoylian fake rock. So it's like a mix again of that concrete that they've put little divots in to make it look like rock work, because I guess it was too expensive back then.
There's a great garden up at, there was a really good nursery when Marilyn Sproul had it. It's a native plants nursery called Goldfields Vegetation. Mm-hmm. And when Marilyn first opened it, we went there because she was a friend of my partner's sister. And it was amazing. And they did that artificial rock to make this wonderful backdrop to the nursery.
Mm.
And it looked really realistic.
Yeah.
So that was good.
Yeah. It really does from afar too. You can't quite tell the difference.
No. Just don't go climbing on it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Not more abseiling.
Good point.
All right, we've got a gardening conundrum from Jane. She has two large Acer negundas that are losing their variegation. Is this because she did some light pruning? The new growth shoots out all green. Can she rescue them by removing all the green limbs? They're very mature trees, about 60 years old.
Yes, I believe that you can. I mean, certainly nothing that I've done myself, and that would definitely be a Stephen question, but I know that if the non-variegated parts are taking over, just get rid of all of the non-variegated parts and let the plant put its energy into the variegated plants, and apparently that it does come back.
Fermi's nodding.
Yeah, the green parts they have got more chlorophyll, and so they'll be more vigorous.
Mm.
And this is an important thing: when you have a variegated plant, you want to keep variegated. You need to prune out anything that's not. So.
Yep. Beautiful. Thanks, guys. Okay, we've got a message come in from Ben and Kerry at Treasured Perennials.
Yo, guys.
Yeah, hey, guys. Look, they have been running around like crazy for the last few months organising the Kiss the Ground event that was held at the Fernie Creek Hort Society a couple of weeks ago. Thanks to the engagement and enthusiasm from everyone involved, they have raised $1,800 for 3CR.
Oh, my goodness.
And we can add it onto our radiothon tally.
Amazing.
Wow.
Absolutely amazing. All of the money that that has been raised, they are not keeping any of it. It has all gone to the station.
Good on you guys. Yeah, wow.
It's
huge.
It's really, really special. So a massive thank you to Ben and Kerry, but they also want to thank a few people who are involved, the Ferny Creek Hort Society, and their Emma is the secretary.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Craig Castry, Virginia Haywood, and Paul and Anita from View Garden, who were involved in the panel and a few demonstrations on the day. It was about 100 people that turned out, and they played the Kiss the Ground movie, and then had the panel. It was a mini festival, and they organised it in just a few months. So
wow.
And it they didn't do it without expense.
Yes.
And this is the thing, that they had to pay for the AV and stuff, and they did it out of their own pocket because they didn't want it to be they wanted all the money to go to 3CR.
Yeah.
Please support Ben and Kerry.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
And they go to a lot of the markets.
Oh, yeah.
That's where
yeah.
you'll find them with their amazing plants.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they bought the rights for the Kiss, to show Kiss the Ground as well too. So, yeah. A huge effort and so kind to do something for the station and for the gardening show like that. So many, many thanks to them.
Thank you.
I hope you've been able to put up their feet and have a rest the last couple of weeks, because I know they've been working really hard on it.
I don't think they do rest, actually.
No, they seem to be
zooming off somewhere or another.
Oh, our lovely listener who's asking about the Bechstenoria has messaged in. Ida, thank you for coming back to us. The plant is about 8 years old and it is in the ground.
I think it might just be the climatic conditions, because if it's in the ground 8 years, it's been established, it's probably not a moisture problem.
Mm.
It's probably more just that the change in temperatures at that time. It depends on when it has actually started happening, of course. But Ida, it would have been nice to talk to you and you could have answered more of our questions.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, because I'm not overly familiar with the plant, but it grows in semi-arid areas in Mexico. We've had a bit of a dry winter and a dry spring, so I'm kind of surprised that maybe it is... struggling in that way.
Mexican plants are a little bit tricky with us because of where we live, because we get frost, which they don't get in Mexico. And so there are some very interesting plants that come from Mexico that we grow in Australia, one of which is called Weldenia. And if you know Tradescantia, you know that triangular flower that they have. Well, imagine a triangular flower about almost an inch long, about 2 centimetres wide, and pure white. And it's one of the few white-flowered species of in this family. It's a tuberous-rooted thing. It looks like a miniature dahlia when it's dormant, and then puts out this tuft of green leaves. Looks a bit like a skilla coming up, and then these little triangular flowers. And ours has been flowering one at a time, but on a good year you'll get 3 or 4 flowers. But I have to keep that under cover during the winter, because it does not want winter wet.
Yep.
Yet one of my friends in the Dandenong grows it in her garden. And you can't get much wetter in winter than the Dandenong.
Yes, crazy.
What? I put the pot on the ground 1 year, and the wet coming up from the soil actually rotted most of the bits. I nearly lost the plant. So, yeah, it's a bit tricky. So Mexico, it's not really that similar to us.
Yeah.
So we do have to take a few more precautions.
Yeah.
But then speaking, we've got a Bechstenoria that's in the rock garden, which doesn't even get water during the summer now, because we haven't watered that part of the garden for ages, and it comes through.
Yeah.
Although, speaking like that, it'll probably die if I don't put water on it this summer.
AB earlier mentioned maybe feeding it. I mean, if you don't want to use a fertiliser product, then maybe sprinkle some compost
I was actually thinking more if it had been in a pot, it might have needed a feed. But
yeah,
it's a tricky one, isn't it?
Yeah. We'll keep troubleshooting with you, could Ida.
Do the good old sea sole, I suppose.
Yeah. Bit of seaweed.
Trusty sea sole.
Yeah, maybe a bit of seaweed around that, yeah. This is the 3CR Gardening Show. We're here till 9:15. I'm Chloe Foster, and with me this morning is AB Bishop, Fermi D'Souza, and Amy Downey. If you want to join the chat, give us a call on 94190155. And the text line is 0488 809 855. Fermi, let's get to some more of your plants.
Well, I didn't think as a rock gardener I'd ever be growing petunias. But I have to admit, I love purple petunias because we had some at the house I bought ages ago. That were planted in the window box, and I realised that they're scented. So you can really get some benefit out of plants that you might see every day, and then you learn something different about them.
Are they a species petunia?
These ones are species. So these are two species, one which is not on Bicon, so I'm not sure how it got into the country, but this is I think this is actually Mexican as well. So this is a red flowering petunia. It has sort of starry flowers, and they're sort of terracotta red. And the other one is a white flowered one called... the red one is Petunia exerta, and it does have an exerted stigma. And then the other one is a white flowered one called Petunia axillaris. And the interesting thing about this is that it's scented in the evenings and nighttime, so it must be moth pollinated. And in our garden, we suddenly had a pink one come up.
Did you?
Do you think they've been playing around? It looks very much like a pink axillaris, so whether they got some genes from the exerta or whether it's just a pink variation, I won't know for sure. It has set seed, so I'm going to see what the second generation come out like.
Yeah, it's
interesting. The red one doesn't even look like a petunia.
No, look, there is a rock garden petunia, which is called Petunia patagonica, and it does not look like a petunia apart from a very bowl-like flower, but it's yellowish with brownish veins. So it looks more like a carnivorous plant. And I'm not sure if that's on Bicon. The trouble is that you very rarely see seed of it available anywhere. So that's one of the problems with trying to grow different things is getting seed into the country. Mm. I know we've got to have very strict biosecurity laws, but they... when I first got into this game of growing things from seed, and that wasn't that long ago, I was in my 20s before somebody suggested grow. I had a plant, it was actually this plant, but an orange one. That's the Ornithogalum dubium. And I gave it to Ruth Tyndale, and her sister said to me, "Oh, did you grow that from seed?" And I just looked at her as if to say, "Grow it from seed? Are you ridiculous? Who ever heard of growing the bulbs from seed?" But yeah, and Ruth introduced me to the idea of joining overseas societies because they had seed exchanges. And back in the 80s, Australia didn't have a biosecurity allowed list. So now when you go onto Bicon, you'll find the seed that are allowed into Australia. What they had back then was a not allowed list, which included things like cannabis sativa and alliums and things like that. So things that would affect the horticultural industry or the more likely the farming industry, you weren't allowed to bring in. But then over the years, the system got revamped, and then it became a not allowed list became much more broad. And then it became you had an allowed list and a not allowed list. And this was, I think, something that was happening in New Zealand as well. In New Zealand, they went to all the nurseries and said, "Tell us what you've got." And some of the nurseries were very suspicious of this, and so they didn't tell them everything they had growing. But what MAF did in New Zealand was they made it that you could only bring plants into New Zealand, or even a seed, if they were on this allowed list. And they went to the extent of, if they saw something that was not on the allowed list, they would destroy it. And they had a ridiculous situation where some taxonomist renamed one of I think it might have been a conifer of some sort, and they renamed this conifer. It had been in New Zealand for generations. Mm. And suddenly they went to the nursery and said, you need to destroy those, they're not on the allowed list. And it was sort of like, are you kidding me?
Mm.
It was so
wild.
Strict as the Australian conditions are, they are not as daft as the New Zealand ones. So I mentioned this now because we're coming into the seed exchange season. So we've got groups like the Scottish Rock Garden Club and the North American Rock Garden Society, as well as the Cyclamen Society and others, that will send seed to Australia. They will get a phytos to send the seed to Australia with. A phytosanitary certificate. So it's a piece of bureaucratic red tape that really doesn't matter if the parcel of seed gets stopped by biosecurity. They will then charge you $35 every 15 minutes for inspection time, regardless of whether it has a phyto, whereas the phyto should be saying to them, these seed are okay, you can let them in. But it's like two bits of government are not talking to each other, and so therefore, why bother getting a phyto if they're going to inspect them anyway? Mm. So it's we're a bit on edge about that, but we just have to touch wood that we get the seeds in safely. But the societies overseas now know that if something is not on the allowed list in BICON, BICON will send the whole packet back. Even if one packet out of 300 is not on BICON, they will send the whole packet back to wherever it came from. So now they actually do double checking to make sure that any seed they send to Australia is on the BICON allowed list. So they're very, they are trying to do the right thing as well.
Mm.
So, what we did in the Victorian group of the Alpine Garden Society is we started our own seed exchange within our members. And we have sometimes 300 different types of seed on the exchange list. And it's only open to members. So members can just get free seed. We cover the cost of the seed and the postage. But we get something like 2,000 packets of seed, and you might only get like 300 taken by members. So then what happens is that we package the seeds, all packaged and labelled, and we take it to things like the Ferny Creek Horticultural Society's Plant Expo in February, and it's March, I think.
March.
So that we'll sell packets of seed there. We've gone to Broughton Hall. We have a bioswap cell, which next year is going to be in April, and we'll sell the seed there. And we sell quite a lot of seed that way. And it's all, very good, fresh seed. It's all this season's seed. And it germinates very well. We had one year before Joan Tonkin started her own seed side of the business, she donated packets and packets and packets of Fritillaria imperialis.
Oh.
And the people who got it said it germinated like cress. It was just amazing. So, but of course, Jane now is another sideline of Tonkin's, has a seed business as well. So if you go onto their website, you'll see the sort of things they have available.
Yeah.
And she sells them at the Ferny Creek Society Expo as well. So,
yeah, the whole what you can and can't grow is interesting. One of the
things that we have trouble with in the magazine is a lot of people love growing poppies, of course, and the opium poppy, Papaver somniferum, is illegal to grow in Australia, but you can still buy the seed. So there's various subspecies of it which are essentially bred for their amazing flowers, because they they do have incredible flowers. But yeah, there's this really sort of tricky element around it, because yeah, you can sell the seeds, but you're not supposed to be able to grow them. But a lot of people, of course, grow them because they're beautiful. But being bred for the flowers, they don't have that same sort of they don't have the opium qualities to them, essentially.
What a bummer.
But anything that's in the magazine. You know, if you just by mistake, you know, zoom in on a plant that, you know, might have a opium poppy in the background, for sure you'll get people writing in saying, you know, we're not allowed to grow them in Australia. Yeah. But
I think we've got to check that out, because I said that to somebody once and they said, no, it's not actually illegal to grow the plant.
It is.
But it's now.
Yeah, it is illegal. Yeah. So that's just the somniferum, not the other species. Yeah,
that's what I was wondering, if people maybe also don't know, because they are being sold, they just assume that, of course, then you could grow it in your garden.
But yeah, it's a slightly tricky one. But yeah. I mean, they're so beautiful. But there's some people who want to break the subspecies away from somniferum so that we can legally grow them.
Yeah.
Well, that would be a good idea, because the opium poppy itself, we've seen opium poppies that are the garden poppies, the seed pod gets to about maybe 3 centimetres across, but the opium poppies are about double that size. Mm. And because of course, opium is made by putting a slit down the green pod, and the exudate from that is the opium.
Mm.
And I think somebody once mentioned to me that they went to a botanic gardens, which will not be mentioned, wasn't Melbourne, and they saw the opium poppies there, and the garden poppies, and said something about it, and the curator took out a little matchbox, and there was these little brown beads in it, and said, yeah, we collected one just to see what it would do. And but that would be, and in actual fact, virtually every poppy will produce opium.
Not to the commercial amount. Yeah.
But at one stage, the plant police actually went to a friend's nursery and dug up Oriental poppies, because they said, oh, these can still produce opium. And it was sort of like, you guys are out of your minds. Yeah. But anyway.
That's like Stephen's oxalis fight.
Yeah.
Yes, they banned a plant that's native to Australia.
Exactly. All right, let's get to a couple more text messages. Fermi, you've got a fan. Someone says, lovely to hear Fermi on the radio. Smiley face. Nicola from Eltham. Says, hi everyone, I've taken cuttings from Corazema, Prostanthra and Dodonea procumbens about 8 weeks ago. How do I tell if there are roots without tipping them out? There's 9 cuttings in a low pot with sand vermiculite and perlite.
Just give them a gentle tug. And, and if they hold, then they're starting to develop roots, and if they come out, they're not.
Yep. And if they come out and there's no roots, then just put them back in again.
Yeah, put them back in if they're calloused over, and knock the callus off. Yeah. And
if they're still green, and, you know, after 8 weeks, then they're still alive and there's still chance of getting roots off them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So back on to seed collecting. This listener says, back on growing bulbs from seeds, they're wondering if they could dry ranunculi flower heads as they finish flowering and collect the seeds to plant.
Yeah. So once they've finished flowering, they'll start to dry off. When the stem below the seed head starts looking dry, you can cut them off because they're not giving any more food to the seeds, and put them in a paper bag, allow them to dry off in the paper bag, not plastic, because plastic will tend to allow any moisture to sweat, and that'll rot them. But if you put them into a paper bag, allow them to dry, and then in the autumn you can sow them.
Okay. Because so you would do, so you'd have to wait until that stem starts to brown off, because sometimes if you pick plants before the seed, before the fruit has ripened, the seed won't germinate. So you need to wait till the stem goes brown
with,
for
with
ranunculus?
With certain types of ranunculus. So the ranunculus, the ones that we grow for spring flowers are the sort that you wait for them to dry. There are others that actually produce fleshy seed and you don't let them dry out at all.
Yeah, okay.
But these ranunculus, they're perfectly fine for collecting. When the plant if the plant's looking dry already, you can just cut the whole plant down. You can remove, dig up the root of the plant, because ranunculus roots are quite hardy. They do tend to desiccate a bit if you just keep them in a paper bag, but if you plant put the roots in damp vermiculite or something like that, they'll keep through until you're ready to plant them, or you can just keep them in the ground. So depending on which, where they are, they don't say where.
Don't know where. Don't know what sort of ranunculus either.
Yeah, well, if they're talking about the ranunculus that have flowered in the spring, yeah.
Okay.
So the ones we grow as, that most people used to grow ranunculus and anemones that they would have bought from the nurseries in the autumn and planted them out. Yeah, so that would be the sort I'm talking about.
Yeah, okay. All right. Thank you, Fermi. We finally have a listener. Good morning to a listener calling in. Good morning to Lizzie in Geelong. Are you there?
I'm here.
Hello. Thank you for calling in.
I was just curious. I was talking to Doug on the line and he told me a bit about it. I recently planted vegetable seeds and some cucumber seeds were like bright blue when I took them out of the packet, and some other corn seeds looked a bit shriveled and red, but they had coverings on them and I'd never seen that before, and I was wondering, you know, what was happening with the seeds.
That's essentially just to protect them from fungicide and protect them from rotting. So they just spray them.
Yeah, it just seemed really weird, and like there was no sort of information on the packet or anything, and I didn't know whether to plant them or not. I thought, are they alien?
Yeah. Are you saying that the blue colouring is the fungicide that's been sprayed on
that's
them?
That's right, yeah. And the pink for the corn.
Ah.
Yeah.
It's not because you can get different coloured corn varieties.
No, it's actually, yeah, fungicide.
No, it's really strange. And I thought, what's going on? Have I just bought a bad bunch? But
no, not at all. So that's essentially to keep them healthy.
Yeah.
So they don't rot in the packet.
Read anything about it or...
Yeah, they should mention that.
They probably should put that on the packet. Yeah.
Like all of a sudden I've got bright blue cucumber seeds. This is a bit weird.
They probably mentioned it on the website or something like that.
Yeah.
But you'll often see, we planted out some zucchini seedlings and the seed coat was still attached to the plant and they were bright pink.
Mm.
So they'd been sprayed with something to prevent them rotting before they germinate.
Yeah.
Oh, and I showed them to my little grandson and he thought they were brilliant.
You know? Well, if it makes him eat his veggies, then that's a good thing.
Yeah, I don't know about that. But no. Oh, well, that's good. I know now. And thank you all for a wonderful show, as usual. I've just learnt so much from this program and I love it.
Good.
So thank you.
Oh, you're Lizzie. Very welcome. And thank you very much for calling in this morning. And I think you messaged in earlier. So thank you very much.
Yes.
Yeah, cool. All right. Okay. Enjoy your day and good luck with your veggies.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Listener, a cheeky listener that will remain unnamed, messaged in saying that they mentioned on 3CR a few years ago that the entire front yard of Traralgon Police Station was covered in so-called opium poppies.
Excellent. I love it.
AB.
Yeah.
The magazine that you are horticultural editor of Woohoo. Has had their lovely December issue come out.
Yes, beautiful. December issue is out. There's lots of goodies, as per usual.
And free wrapping paper, a student told me.
Oh, yes.
He was really excited about it.
Yes, yeah. I've already pulled it out. And, beautifully, I forget who the wrapping paper was designed by now, but it's a botanical artist who specialises in native. So the wrapping paper is native and it's double-sided. And, yes, that was our little treat for readers. And we're busily printing it off madly in the office just onto normal paper to use as wrapping paper. It's really gorgeous. But, yeah, so December issue is out now and it does have natives on the cover.
One of the stories in there is about climbers.
It is, yes. We've got Stephen Ryan has done a story on climbers. That is for the next. That's for an issue coming up.
Is
the climbing issue? Yeah, it's so funny because we're literally halfway through February now, so it's really hard for me to work out A, what month I'm in, and B, what was in the magazine. By the time the magazine's delivered, Ray's like, "Oh, what's in this one?" I was like, "Got no idea." Open it up and tell me. December issue is natives on the front, and it's a beautiful table, festive table design. So we've asked. There was a couple of really sort of floral planty people. So Donna Hamilton, who's from WA, and she's a florist and really into natives, and the lovely Petrina Burrell from Melbourne, who a lot of people will know. She's been on Gardening Australia a couple of times and in the magazine. She has this most incredible sort of perennial gardens with poppies, all sorts of beautiful things,
stunning.
And bulbs, etc., wisteria. And so Donna's done these festive table decorations for us with natives, and Petrina has done them with non-natives, and they're super colourful and beautiful. So whatever you're into, if you want to do yourself a beautiful festive table covering for Christmas, there's some inspiration in the magazine, and you know the how-tos, how to actually do it, and it's really very simple. So that's sort of one of the lovely things in the mag. And then there's a story by Steve Falcioni on scented plants, which is terrific. And one of the things that we're trying to do in the mag is not only write about all the different varieties, so we try and have like a top 10 or a top 12 or whatever of these plants that are really good garden plants for whatever purpose you want to use, but also just give a sort of a little bit of more interesting information. So Steve sort of goes into the science of scent and how things like roses actually have 400 chemicals that give us the scents that they give us, and how scents are broken into either sort of the sweet, that sort of real sort of nectary type scent, which the bees and butterflies, etc., we know are absolutely drawn to, and then the sort of real sort of pungent smells, which the flies and beetles and those type of critters are drawn to. So there's, Steve's got a great story, and he's sort of broken down into shrubs, climbers and trees, just the different scented plants. And so that's a really fantastic story. And Stephen's, in this particular issue, he's got a story on water-wise plants. So, again, the sort of top 10 water-wise plants. And I have to say it's been a real treat having Stephen write for the magazine.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're a commissioning editor, one of the key things is you really want your writers to stick to the word length, get the story, because I cannot tell you, because... And as a horticulturalist, I'm sort of, I totally agree with people. You know, you say, you know, can you write about this particular plant in 400 words, 500 words? And it doesn't matter how many words you give people, they're just like, oh, it's not enough words. Yeah. I need more words. It's like, no, just stick to the words. And Stephen, bless his cotton socks, he will stick to the word length, get stories in on time. Oh, but man. Of course, it's always in Stephen's voice. And he just has such a unique way of describing plants and also brings his extreme knowledge to them. So, you know, he can just present, you know, we like to have these mini profiles of the plants, and they might be 60 to sort of 80 words. And Stephen can do it. Like, he can really let you know the intricacies of these plants in that sort of short snippet, you know, where it grows, you know, the aspect it lights, all those sorts of things. So thank you to Stephen for writing for the magazine. We really appreciate having him on
board.
I was
looking at reading one of his articles in the recent magazine, and I don't know whether you selected the plants or whether it was a combination.
But I select the natives, and he and so I tell him what natives to write, because we like to have equal amount of natives and non-natives.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, but you wouldn't know that Stephen, you know, he has slightly lesser knowledge of the natives. He's still got good knowledge, but you when you're reading it, you wouldn't know.
Yeah.
You just think he knows his plant backwards.
Yeah, it's a really lovely combination. And the exotic stuff that he talks about, it's not your, you know, classic Stephen. It's not your stock standard exotics. There's some really cool things that he recommends for. I can't remember. Maybe it was like shady.
Oh, yeah.
Shady shrubs or something like that that he did recently. And it was just some really cool plants that he was talking about.
Yeah.
It was awesome.
And in the mag, we've also got a feature on the lovely Margot McDonald's garden out in Kyneton. So Margot and James and...
Just out of Kyneton,
yeah, yeah. And wow, what she's done out there is incredible. Really have to get out there and have a wander around it. But she has created an absolute masterpiece.
It is a that was a really beautiful story. And the photos in that are stunning.
Yeah.
But what Margot has created in a really challenging climate. Fermi, do you have similar conditions to Margot?
Similar. She's probably a little bit better off for rainfall, but sometimes it's very variable, that part of central Victoria.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we saw her garden a few years ago when she'd only been there a couple of years, and you would have thought she'd been there 10 years.
Really?
She's really developed this really wonderful garden.
It's quite unique, and she has this unbelievable knack, which I think you either have it or you don't have it, of being able to pretty much just chuck anything in a bed and make it work. And I don't know how some people have that real knack, you know, how much thought actually goes into, you know, the shape of the foliage, the shape of the plant, etc. But she has a really good knack for being able to combine plants, because there's some varieties in there which are really unusual, and how she's shaped them or dealt with them or positioned them next to something else, quite incredible. Yeah. So done a great job.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So
it's a good issue, mate.
It is a good issue, and lovely Angus Stewart has got a story in there on Xerocrysum bracteatum.
Beautiful.
And, such a sweet little plant, and he's doing a lot of breeding on that at the moment and coming up with these incredible flower colours. So watch that space for Angus in the future. There'll be a lot of new varieties out there.
Did you title it Net Zero Chrysum?
Oh, no, but you know what? Thanks, Fermi. I'm going to write that down, because doing the titles and everything, like, sometimes you come up with some absolute doozies. I'm going to keep that one for the future. Thanks so much for that.
When you were talking about scent, one of the best scents at the moment is lemon verbena, not the foliage. The flowers have got an incredible scent. So if you have lemon verbena in flower, just avoid touching the flowers, because otherwise all you'll smell is lemon. Mm. But if you sniff the flowers, they're sort of gardenia-like.
Beautiful.
It's really, really beautiful scent.
Okay. There is one at work. I'm going to stop by it. That's flowering. My one at home isn't flowering at the moment, but it's in a bit of a shadier spot. Very cool. And AB, just lastly, you brought in the Victorian Christmas bush.
Yeah, I should go through very quickly what I've been in and brought in. And they're all sort of creamy white, and I love this time of year. So sort of through winter and early spring, we've got the yellow of the wattles and the hardenbergia and the indigofera, so the sort of yellows and purples, and that sort of gives way to the peas, the sort of darker yellows / oranges. And then at this time of year, it just seems to be real creams.
I've noticed that too at the moment.
Yeah, which is fantastic. So we've got the Victorian Christmas bush, the Prostantha lacianthos, and it's one of the few mint bushes which doesn't really have very minty. Still has fragrant leaves, but it's not really as minty as some of the other mint bushes. But this plant is flowering now, and it'll flower through until
sort of mid-December. Again, does depend on where it's positioned. Where I've picked these particular ones, it's in a very wet gully and they grow under the tall eucalypt, so they do appreciate a bit of sort of dappled shade at least. But they can get up to about 15 metres and they're just a beautiful sort of slightly open canopy tree and quite sort of longish green leaves with tooth margins and, yeah, the just beautiful little white flowers with a sort of purple dapple throat. And there is a pink form as well. But, yeah, these are – they're gorgeous.
They're
and
really beautiful.
Yeah, just a sort of – sort of medium tree, I suppose. So if you don't want anything too towering in the garden, that's a real goodie.
And they grow quick too.
They do. Mm. They are fast growers. And, yeah, at this time of year in the bush, they just really light up those sort of darker spots. And one of the ones that I brought in, which is actually starting to seed now, so this is one of the native clematis. This is Clematis microphylla. And you only notice it when it's flowering, sort of in late winter to early spring, and then when it starts going to seed, that so you sort of can appreciate it twice, and then for the rest of the year, you wouldn't even know it's there. So this is, I think we've got six native clematis species, something like that. And microphylla has a sort of finer leaves. There's also Aristata here in Melbourne, and they both sort of can be referred to as, you know, goat's beard or old man's beard, just because when they're at the, yes, Fermi, I'm looking, actually, yeah,
Fermi's does beard. Look
very like Fermi, yeah, we'll rename it Fermi's beard.
Yeah.
At this time of year, the beautiful fluffy seed heads are pretty much what you notice.
They're
but
gorgeous.
It's such a lovely plant. Like it grows in pretty much from full shade to full sun. Mm. And it's one of these plants which sort of, it's a gentle climber, so it'll scramble up things. And that's how you notice it. So, of course, they scramble up to get to the light as much as possible for the flowering. And, and then this time of year you appreciate the fluffy seed heads.
Yeah.
So they climb via tendrils and just a gorgeous little plant to have in the garden.
I'm a big fan.
Lovely.
Yeah,
I like
yeah.
it.
Mm. Thank you for bringing those in. We just before we finish up, we've got a text message to get to, which I just missed before. Sandra from Sylvan asks if she can lift a jonquil bulbs even though the leaves are still green. That's usually dry by now, but she needs to relocate them.
Well, I mean, if you have to relocate, you have to.
Yeah.
Not ideal, but you'd try and take some of the soil with, I'd say, and just maybe put them in a pot even and let them continue their sort of dying down process, putting that.
Yeah, or in a big bucket or something.
Yeah,
with a couple
something
holes
like
in
that.
It.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
Fermi,
yeah.
anything to add?
You can lift any of the narcissus now because they should be starting to die off. If they're still absolutely green, then replant them somewhere and give them a little bit of water, but try not to get water on them during the summer.
Yep.
That's the main thing.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Susie's just messaged in, says there's a couple of open gardens, Victoria Gardens open today at Moriac. There's some art and plants for sale at those, and the Garang Garden has CWA catering, and she must have gone yesterday. They're really beautiful gardens. So any more information on those can be found on the Open Gardens Victoria website. We have come to the end of another 3CR gardening show. AB Bishop, Fermi D'Souza, Amy Downey, thank you so much for your time and knowledge this morning. This has been very lovely. Well worth getting up early for. Doug Humbert in the studio, thank you so much as always.
Thanks, Doug.
Daniel Jackson, Tom McLaren for our socials and podcasting. We wouldn't be able to do it without everyone in the background too, so thank you very, very much. To our listeners who texted in and the one who called in today, thank you very much for being a part of the show. We really appreciate it. We will be back again next Sunday at 7:30. Have a very, very lovely day, everyone. See you later.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.